Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
For this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast, 2-for-1 Habeas Corpus Special Edition. I'm your host, Bridget Flaherty. In June 2017, the Supreme Court decided two cases involving habeas corpus petitions filed by state prisoners challenging the validity of their convictions and/or sentences, Davila v. Davis and McWilliams v. Dunn. The petition in Davila v. Davis involved a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. Eric Davila was convicted in a Texas court of capital murder. Although his trial attorney had objected to one of the court's jury instructions on intent, the court had overruled the objection. On direct appeal, his appellate counsel raised various claims, but did not challenge the jury instruction ruling. His conviction and sentence were affirmed by the state's highest criminal court, and the U.S. Supreme Court denied cert. Davila then initiated a collateral attack on his conviction. He sought habeas relief in state court, but his attorney challenged neither the jury instruction ruling nor the failure of his appellate counsel to raise the alleged instructional error on direct appeal. Texas' highest criminal court ultimately denied relief, and the U.S. Supreme Court again denied cert. Davila next raised a habeas claim in federal court, alleging that his appellate counsel provided ineffective assistance by failing to challenge the allegedly erroneous jury instruction on direct appeal, although his failure to have raised that claim in his state habeas petition ordinarily constituted a fatal procedural default, Davila argued for an exception on the grounds that the failure was itself the result of ineffective assistance by a state habeas counsel. The Federal District Court denied Davila's petition, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit denied a certificate of appealability for further review. The Supreme Court granted certiorari, however, to consider whether the ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel provided cause to excuse the procedural default. By a vote of 5-4, the Supreme Court affirmed the judgment of the Fifth Circuit. In an opinion delivered by Justice Thomas, the court held that the ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel does not provide cause to excuse the procedural default of claims of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. Justice Thomas's majority opinion was joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Kennedy, Alito, and Gorsuch. Justice Breyer filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. The petition in McWilliams v. Dunn involved the scope of a state's duty, identified by the Supreme Court in its 1985 decision in Ake v. Oklahoma, to provide an indigent defendant with access to a mental health expert who is sufficiently available to the defense and independent from the prosecution, to effectively assist in evaluation, preparation, and presentation of the defense. In 1986, James McWilliams Jr. was convicted by an Alabama jury of capital murder. Although a state commission, convened after McWilliams' counsel requested a psychiatric evaluation, found that he was competent to stand trial and had not been suffering from mental illness at the time of his alleged crime. His counsel had also asked for neurological and neuropsychological testing while the parties awaited sentencing. The examining doctor concluded that McWilliams had some genuine neuropsychological problems, and his attorney also received various updated mental health records just before the sentencing hearing convened. Although the attorney sought a continuance and the assistance of someone with psychological expertise to evaluate this new material, the trial court denied those requests and sentenced McWilliams to death. Alabama's appellate courts affirmed his conviction and sentence on direct appeal, and his effort to obtain state post-conviction relief also failed. On federal habeas review, the district court found that the requirements described in Ake had been satisfied and denied McWilliams relief. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit affirmed, but the Supreme Court granted certiorari to consider whether the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals' determination that McWilliams got all the assistance to which Ake entitled him was contrary to or involved in unreasonable application of clearly established federal law under the federal habeas statute. By a vote of 5-4, the Supreme Court reversed the judgment of the 11th Circuit and remanded the case. In an opinion delivered by Justice Breyer, the court indicated that Alabama's provision of mental health assistance fell dramatically short of what Ake requires, and therefore concluded that the Alabama court decision affirming McWilliams' conviction and sentence was contrary to or involved in unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. Although the 11th Circuit had alternatively held that any error by the Alabama courts lacked the substantial and injurious effect or influence required to warrant a grant of habeas relief, the Supreme Court indicated that the 11th Circuit should reconsider on remand whether access to the type of meaningful assistance in evaluating, preparing, and presenting the defense that AIG requires would have mattered to the outcome of McWilliams' case. Justice Breyer's majority opinion was joined by Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Justice Alito filed a dissenting opinion, in which the Chief Justice and Justices Thomas and Gorsuch joined. And now, to discuss the cases, we have Joseph Tartakovsky, Deputy Solicitor General for the State of Nevada.
Now, these are both habeas corpus cases, which on their surface tend to be dry and even labyrinthine, but gain, I think, immense interest with a touch of historical background about habeas. It's good for the layperson to know, and even practitioners forget where it all started. Habeas corpus is an ancient English doctrine. It's Latin for you have the body, that allowed prisoners to challenge their detention by the king. Today it appears in many contexts. If you're picked up for dealing meth and you haven't had access to a magistrate, if you're an enemy combatant held at Guantanamo Bay, two, most commonly today, cases in which a state prisoner challenges his state detention as violating the U.S. Constitution. Now, underlying all of these state habeas cases at bottom, however technical any individual case, is the degree to which federal courts will second-guess state courts when it comes to criminal convictions. Now, this federal power was almost never exercised as a matter of U.S. history, but it gained momentum in the late 1940s, and by 1952, habeas overturnings by federal court were so prevalent that the Conference of State Supreme Court Justices, finding so offensive the notion that a federal trial judge could upend a decision of a state Supreme Court, issued a resolution declaring that only the United States Supreme Court should be able to overrule them. And this was at a time when habeas petitions numbered in the hundreds. Today, it's in the many tens of thousands. And around that same time, members of the U.S. Supreme Court started expressing concern about habeas's growing sweep, not just because of flooding their dockets, but because of federalism irritations that were being caused. Justice Robert Jackson in 1953, concurring in a case called Brown versus Allen, said that state court reversals were so, quote, demoralizing to state court judges because the U.S. Supreme Court's pronouncements as to criminal procedure were themselves so vague and shifting and unpredictable. Congress had its concerns too, which built up over time, and finally led in 1996 to the enactment of AEDPA, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. Prompted by concerns as put by Congressman Henry Hyde, that endless appeals for decades up and down state and federal courts were making a, quote, mockery of the law. So Congress set down a new standard, which is as interpreted by the Supreme Court as follows. A federal court can overrule a state court only if the state court decision made an error, quote, beyond any possibility of fair-minded disagreement. In other words, federal courts are empowered to overturn state court decisions only when the state court acts, in essence, irrationally. The constitutional law was clear, and the state court just blew it. Now, it matters a great deal to many different parties. It matters immensely to inmates. At stake often is life or death, or decades of imprisonment. The issue of false convictions often looms. And it matters to states and to the publics they serve. Interests like the swiftness or certainty of justice, the integrity and respect for state court procedure, and the peace of victims or society at large. It's for all these reasons that habeas continues to be fraught in the U.S. Supreme Court. Often it seems like a proxy war over the constitutionality of the death penalty. Justice Ginsburg, in remarks a few weeks ago, noted that only three states still administer the death penalty, and then added, quote, we may see an end to capital punishment by attrition. Now, many would submit that the leading cause for this attrition is the fact that death penalty convictions are guaranteed to be tied up in courts for years and, in all probability, decades, much of it at state expense. Which brings us to our cases today, both death penalty matters. Davila versus Davis. Eric Davila was convicted of capital murder for opening fire in 2008 on a Hannah Montana-themed birthday party in Fort Worth, Texas. He killed a woman and her 5-year-old grandchild, and he wounded 3 other kids. He was attempting to kill a rival gang member he thought he spotted on the porch. Now, as with most habeas decisions, it gets technical fast. In federal court, Davila claimed that his direct appeal lawyer in the state should have challenged a particular jury instruction. But his state post-conviction attorneys pursued other claims and didn't raise it. Davila said that they were constitutionally ineffective for not challenging the jury instruction. Now, since Davila hadn't raised this ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim in his state habeas proceeding, Texas law barred him from raising it afterwards. And federal courts typically have to dismiss any claim that a former defendant defaulted by not raising it under state law unless the prisoner is able to meet specific exceptions. Now, one exception is a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. But here it was appellate counsel that had made the error, he claimed. The question in this case, simplified, is whether counsel A can raise arguments normally barred because counsel B did not raise them when the time came on appeal. Davila's lawyers warned that without this exception, even compelling claims of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel could go unreviewed. The state of Nevada filed an amicus brief. We replied that this law already allowed such review where a fundamental miscarriage of justice is asserted, and that by expanding the exception for trial to appellate errors, the Supreme Court would invite instability, confusion, and further intrusion on state court decision. Now, what shows how important this is to states is that we had 29 states join Nevada's brief, from Oregon and Alabama to Delaware and North Dakota. The Supreme Court held 5-4 for Texas. Justice Thomas, writing for the majority, explained that the exception for trial blunders was narrow, that trial and appellate rights were different constitutional matters, and that in practical terms, Davila's rule could, quote, flood the federal courts with defaulted claims of appellate ineffectiveness. The court recognized the burden that such a rule would place on states, and in particular the state interest in punishing offenders and in respect for state proceedings. Now, McWilliams versus Dunn, our second case. This involved a rape murder in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, which, one notes, this crime occurred in 1984. Now, McWilliams' sanity was an issue, his sanity at the time of the offense, and a psychological report was prepared at the state trial stage. The trial defense counsel felt that he didn't have enough time from the court to evaluate the issue of sanity and the report that was prepared. Alabama, in its state criminal court, found no constitutional violation. The Alabama Appeals Court held that the requirements of Ake versus Oklahoma, which is the key United States Supreme Court case here governing insanity evaluations, and which was decided in 1985, only required the state to give the defendant a competent psychiatrist to examine him. But the U.S. Supreme Court this last term, 5-4, Justice Breyer writing, found this plainly incorrect. Ake requires, they said, the state to provide the defendant with a psychiatrist to examine him, yes, but also to assist the defendant in the evaluation, preparation, and presentation of the defense. In other words, the Constitution requires a defendant not only to have an expert look at the matter, but having an expert in the defendant's corner. Now, McWilliams typifies the difficulties that make habeas such a complex field of law. First, the uncertainty that makes habeas feel to states, at times, so unfair and unpredictable, the concern that Robert Jackson warned about. Justice Alito wrote the dissent in McWilliams, and he noted that if the law was so clearly established in 1985, and Alabama so irrational to rule as it did, why then had a dozen state and federal courts interpreted Ake over the years in so many different divergent and contrary ways? That hardly suggested, he wrote, clearly established law. The second, as Andrew Brasher, Alabama Solicitor General, argued to the Supreme Court, McWilliams' case, one way or another, had been slogging through state and federal courts for 30 years. And indeed, the Supreme Court was reversing a decision of the Alabama Criminal Court made in 1991. It shows, as well as any case can, how criminal convictions, like habeas law itself, often lack the finality essential to their integrity. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. SCOTUS Cast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUS Cast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.